You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode with Kaspar. Hi, Kaspar. How are you doing?
Hi, Alexander. I'm doing fine. Thanks.
Oh, yeah. Very good. I'm doing fine as well. So in the middle of the summer, it doesn't look like summer outside, but that's actually quite okay if you're working inside anyway and without air conditioning. Today, I want to talk about a topic that has been on my mind for a very long time, because it's not really straightforward. And I have seen lots of discussions about these, lots of different approaches to it. And I'm not even sure whether there's a right way to do it. So today is really just about how can you communicate things in such a way that it's still correct and also understood by the audience. And we'll want to talk about especially the case of adaptive studies and the communication of their results. I think a couple of different topics might also apply to things like multiplicity and p-values around that. But for the case today, let's just imagine we have an adaptive design. So a group's, let's say, very straightforward group sequential design with multiple groups. And you have, after every stop, you can both stop for futility as well as for efficacy. And now the first point is you get to the reporting stage and, let's say, run a report, all your results, the primary efficacy, the secondary efficacy data, as well as your safety data in a manuscript. The first challenge is, now you can't just report it like as if it would have been non-adaptive design. So what do you suggest to have in mind when we report that? What are some kind of first bigger guidances that come to your mind?
Thanks, Alexander, for bringing this up. You're opening a very big box here, which I have to say is maybe not fully satisfactory solved in general. One aspect is if you stop after stage one, I think you can just use what you have because then that inference is no different. So that's the easy case. But assume you have a group sequential design. You have an interim analysis for, say, efficacy and futility after 50% of information. You don't stop. And then you stop maybe at an efficacy interim after 80% of information. What are the issues? The issues in general is your effect as you have tuned this design to have a hypothesis test with type 1 error protection. That's how you design those things. So the hypothesis test piece is taken care of. And this is also what a lot of regulatory guidances are about. You have to be able to reject the null under type 1 error protection. But that's only the first piece, of course. In a drug label, a patient is not so much interested whether you have rejected the null under type 1 error protection. What a patient, which is the who is the ultimate stakeholder of what we do, is interested in is how large is treatment effect. If I take the drug, if I adhere to the drug, all these caveats, of course. However, estimation of that treatment effect might not be straightforward if you have a design with multiple interim analyses. That's true. The first thinking I would go through is, are there scenarios where you can simplify things, where you can say, I know in theory the effect is biased, but maybe in this and that scenario, it doesn't matter so much. Mm-hmm. And there is actually quite some literature about that for group sequential designs where you have some rules of thumb. If you have a reasonable error spending function, if your interim is after 50% of information, and if you then stop for efficacy, we know your treatment effect is biased, but the bias is maybe not so big. So that already gives you some idea. There is literature around that. The next step then is, if you want to be very precise, and typically as statisticians we want to be, the next question to ask is, what bias am I actually interested in? Because there, in these kind of designs, there are different types of biases. The literature calls about conditional bias and unconditional bias. So what are they? The conditional bias gives you the expectation of your estimate. Conditional, you stop at this very stage that you stopped. And if you want to have an estimator that accounts for that conditional bias, it can actually shrink your effect estimate quite dramatically towards the null.
It always shrinks it, isn't it?
Here, I think it does. But the point is, this really what you are interested in? Because ultimately, when we talk about bias or statistical inference, what we're interested in is, at least for frequentist inference, is this repeated sampling paradigm. Mm-hmm. If you repeat the trial many times, I want my estimate to be on point. This is what unbiasedness means. But if you condition at the stage where you stop, kind of this property is lost. So that's why people, and I am among them, I advocate for looking at the unconditional bias. So that's not conditioning on the stage where you stopped. But this gives you proper inference in this kind of, if the trial is repeated many times, paradigm. Still, the sampling distribution, so the distribution of your estimator, is not just a normal as you have when you just have one stage trials, but it's a mixture of truncated normals because you always truncate with the rejection return. So inference is a bit more tricky, but typically that when we talk about that unconditional bias, that bias is for reasonably designed trials and reasonable interims is not so substantial. And you can correct for that, but that's maybe one thing we can discuss later. Yeah, sorry, I interrupted it.
So that's for the first thing for the point estimate, yeah, for your treatment effect, for the primary outcome. The same is also true for the confidence interval, isn't it?
Yes, you can account for that.
It's a little bit more tricky because you don't have this nice bell curve anymore.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That you have a curve with ups and downs, so it's multimodal. And your confidence interval is not, so to say, the smallest length. It can be actually longer because you have these, so to say, holes in it that you cover in as well.
Yeah, it's true. Inference in general is more tricky. There is another complexity because you have a sampling space that looks more tricky. Imagine you have a two-stage trial and you have an outcome. You can either stop at the first stage, and then it's, if you want to compute a p-value, for a p-value, we need a concept of ordering, because a p-value is what is my probability to observe what I have seen or something more extreme.
Yeah.
But now, if you have a multi-stage trial, if you have a result and both stopped at the same stage and one effect is larger than the other, the ordering is clear.
Yeah.
But how do I compare a trial that, or a result that has stopped at the first stage and has some effect estimate with one that has stopped at the second stage and has some effect estimate.
Yep.
And there are different approaches how you can order that sample space. Typically, what people have zoomed in on is what we call stage-wise ordering, which means you first look at the same stage and then you just compare the treatment effect. And something that is stopped earlier is always a larger effect than something that is stopped later. So that's what people call stage-wise ordering. And this has some useful properties. For example, when you reject the null hypothesis, your p-value is always smaller than the respective alpha at that stage. And also, loosely speaking, your p-value does not depend on the future. It does not depend on information levels of later stages and beyond the stage at which you stop. So these are all kind of these technical complexities. But if you say, I buy into this stage-wise ordering, you can actually do inference and you can compute something like median unbiased estimators of a treatment effect. And that is maybe quite a straightforward way to assess whether you have bias. If your naive estimate, ignoring the conditional sampling that you have, or you passed an interim analysis, this naive estimator is maybe not too different from a median unbiased estimator, which you can compute with any reasonable software. Yeah, then maybe there's not much to worry about. If these two are very discrepant, maybe there's some reason to look into things more carefully.
So median unbiased is basically the same as unbiased, just applying the median instead of the mean. Yeah.
So median unbiased means you look at a confidence interval, basically at the upper limit of a one-sided 50% confidence interval. And once you have agreed on an ordering of the sample space, you can not only compute p-values, you can also compute confidence intervals. So you basically look at a one-sided 50% confidence interval, and this upper limit is your median unbiased estimator. And you then also have a concept of confidence interval for that immediately.
Okay. Yeah, that's a nice thing, because for the median, you just need the ordering and you don't need to calculate any distances, which becomes really difficult in that space. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now we have these means, we have medians, we have confidence intervals, we have p-values for the primary analysis. Now, how does that look like? Because all the studies I have worked on, and I haven't worked so much on oncology, had lots of secondary endpoints. There are lots of different questionnaires, quality of life, functioning, all kind of different things. How do we actually then report on these? Because on these, there's no decision made. However, of course, very often they are correlated to the primary endpoint.
That's yet another very good question. And something that is often also coming up in discussion with regulators, that we may design a very clever adaptive design, and we design that around the primary endpoint. And then we account for the selective nature of the sampling, for example, through bias-corrected estimators. And we run simulations to evaluate the bias that we potentially have, and then we correct for that bias, etc. But we only do that for the primary endpoint. There are, as you rightly say, there are secondary endpoints. There is safety. For safety, we typically look at what we have. We don't pull p-values or do inference that accounts for the adaptive nature of the design. And I think this may be one of also the challenges of adaptive designs. And that if you look into ICHE20, the draft, maybe there are some hints that maybe we should start to look into this a bit more. But that's not the end of the story, because it's not just that for secondary endpoints, efficacy endpoints, for example, we often ignore the selective sampling nature of an adaptive design or a group sequential design for that matter. Often we also have quite complicated graphical-based alpha recycling methods for these secondary endpoints. They also stand in the way of just naive inference being valid.
Yeah.
So what do we do there? So we have actually two aspects that complicate matters. It's one is sometimes you see very complicated graphical procedures. And again, the primary focus is on what regulators push on industry is basically by saying this is somehow common wisdom, and it might be true or not true in one or the other instance. But in general, I think it's fair to say what you have type 1 error protected and you get significant with rejection of the null of that specific endpoint, you have a good chance that ends up in the label. However, it's somehow the statistical theory and the statistical pre-specification when designing trials stops there. Very often we don't say, what is then the inference? And should the, and then there are multiple questions. Should the inference take into account first the fact you have an adaptive design, and second, the fact that your endpoints are part of a complicated type 1 error strategy? Then the next question I think we sometimes underappreciate is bias the criteria we should optimize for, or should it not be estimation efficiency? Also, ICHE20, the draft, actually says something about that. These are all questions that where we have as a drug development community some room for improvement, I think, to be clear what we want. And as statisticians who are key to design trials, that we also think not just up to rejection of certain hypotheses pertaining to certain endpoints, but even further, because you have to write something in the label that you can argue, and some do, that should be accurate. If you say this is a 95% confidence interval, that should have that property.
There's the one thing is the discussion with the regulators. And the thing that is that you are usually talking to experts on the other side. And it's the benefit is you're pretty much talking more or less directly to them. And then you can explain all the technical details and so forth. And also the label in itself is a very condensed way of how results are displayed. Especially the part that is really the indication statement and all these kind of different things. It becomes more challenging when you present it, for example, to a scientific audience at a conference or a publication, or even more when it goes into kind of more layman's term, let's say the average physician or patient, you go to these levels. But let's stay with the scientific community. So, for the secondary endpoints, people, I don't know why, but people always want to see p-values. Yeah. And you very only get it published if you have these also for your secondary endpoints. Now, would you, and we had the case of you have an adaptive group sequential design and stop second or third readout, would you report then the nominal p-values for the secondary endpoints as if it would have been a standard design without adaptive features? Would you create something that is more adjusted? And if so, what, how would we adjust for it? Or would you say no p-values at all?
Maybe these are multiple questions into one, acknowledging that many people don't appropriately interpret p-values, maybe we should cite them less often. But that's just a band-aid, because it doesn't really solve the underlying problem. Even if we say we should report more confidence intervals, for many designs, it is not obvious how to compute them. If it were simple, maybe we would do it more often. But as I said, do you then want unbiasedness? Do you want estimation efficiency? Do you want to account for the adaptive nature of the design? Do you want to account for the complicated multiple testing strategy that you had? Do confidence interval need to reflect, for a very simple hypothesis test, you have this one-to-one correspondence between, if the confidence interval is not including your null, this corresponds to a rejection of the null. Is this a feature you want to have from confidence intervals, that this correspondence remains if you compute a confidence interval after a complicated multiple testing strategy? I don't have answers to these questions. These are trade-offs for some designs, for some methods, these adjusted, so to say, inference exists. For others, maybe less. I think regulators also have an eye on, in some sense, fairness. What if somebody adjusts for all these things and another company, same drugs, same comparator, does not? These are very difficult questions. I don't have template answers to.
Yep. One last thing. All of these only work pre-planned, isn't it? You can't do any of this post hoc, all these kind of adjustments. You need to have that all pre-specified, isn't that?
In general, I think in our environment, I would say yes. I think a p-value after the fact, after you have looked at a lot of data and then you just compute it for one thing that you have seen is maybe interesting, I don't think has the properties that we would a p-value wish to have. Maybe there are methods, post-selection inference and these kind of things, but this is not something we routinely do. I think pre-specification serves more than one purpose. I think one is to establish the statistical properties of inference that we want to have. Pre-specification also avoids cherry picking, at least maybe they are somewhat related in certain instances, but I think this is why regulators want to see pre-specification, and they rightly do.
Yeah. It also builds trust generally. You do what you say and you say what you do. And this is what, for me, pre-specification also means. It helps you that you can trust in your data, and if someone else would have run the analysis, would have come pretty much to the same conclusion. Yeah, that is, and I think that's really vital.
And that's yet another thing when you say if somebody else runs the analysis, will come to the same conclusion. There is a lot of research and meta research on precisely that aspect. If you give the same data and the same statistical analysis plan to 20 teams of statisticians, you will get 20 different results because there are still so many ambiguities on the way. But I agree in general to the principle that pre-specification builds trust. And you can argue it's quite amazing that we decide on introduction of a drug, yes or no, based on a primary endpoint. So we spend $150 million for a trial. The p-value is 0.07. Very often, there's no drug. People working in an academic environment, for them, that's very difficult to grasp. But I think it's actually, as you say, this is building the credibility. This is just being very often a reasonable hurdle. And it's not if the p-value is smaller than 5%, you immediately get approval. I keep saying this is an entry ticket to negotiations with a regulator. And then it's still about comprehensiveness of the evidence. How was the trial conducted? What were the assumptions? All these aspects still play a role. There is no automatism, but you need to jump a first hurdle, which is a pre-specified, properly designed experiment for a pre-specified, prospectively specified hypothesis.
Thanks so much, Caspar, for this really good discussion. And you already mentioned ICH E20. Please have a look into this guideline. You mentioned a couple of points about this. So there's still time to provide comments to it. So please do that as well. Thanks so much, Caspar. Another great discussion. And I feel honored always to have these discussions with you because I always learn something new, and that's quite enjoyable. Thanks so much.
No, thank you, Alexander.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.